Hello and welcome to Tech Shock from ParentZone, the podcast that looks at the impact of digital technologies on family life for parents, teachers, professionals and policymakers. I'm Vicky Schott-Bolt, CEO of ParentZone, and I'm here with Geraldine Bedell, Executive Editor at ParentZone. I wasn't here last week, Geraldine, and I'm a bit jealous because I think it was a really good conversation.
Yeah, it was a really good conversation, and I hope I'll be able to stick with it this week because I've got COVID. So if I don't make any sense or if I suddenly have a coughing fit, that's why.
Well, we're sending you healthy wishes.
Thank you. Thank you. I bet you're glad you're not in the same room as me. Today, we're delighted to welcome Frank Kelly, who is Professor of the Mathematics of Systems at Cambridge University and lead researcher of a recent report for the Royal Society, The Online Information Environment, which is about how online misinformation and disinformation is affecting science. Hello, Frank. Are you in Cambridge today?
I am, yes.
Good, good. Well, we're really thrilled that you could join us. And you make the point early on in the report that misinformation is not a new phenomenon, but dates back to before the internet. Is it something that's always been a problem for scientists?
Well, I suppose misinformation has been a feature of human life ever since we started to communicate with each other. There are clear historical examples going back to Roman Greek times. I was very interested over lockdown. I joined a book club and we've read some very fascinating books. But a couple of 19th century great authors, Dickens and George Eliot, each have very, very clear descriptions of misinformation. In Barnaby Rudge, there's an account of a mob coming across the Thames to the House of Commons at the time of the Gordon riots in the 1780s. And in Middlemarch, George Eliot describes the opposition to the new hospital to deal with fever cases, where she describes echo chambers. She describes that the bounds of ignorance and a very clear account of what one could view as even an account of what is happening on the internet today. So I think the medium has changed, but that human societies are prone to produce and to consume and not quite to understand misinformation. That's been true since human beings started to communicate with each other.
We quite often lose that perspective, don't we, and talk about mis and disinformation as though it were an entirely online phenomenon. But I do think there is something unique about the online space. It does tend to favour the shouty and the direct, and the algorithms promote strong opinion. We know that science by its very nature is really uncertain and evolving. Do you think in that context science is facing a particular difficulty online?
I think science has benefited hugely from the internet and from the various services it enables. I mean, if you just think of the recent example of the pandemic, then the genome sequence of a new virus was able to be shared rapidly and widely, and the results of various clinical trials and various scientific results produced in off-prints were able to be circulated quickly and allow science to progress very rapidly at a time when we needed it to progress very rapidly. So there's no question that the online information environment has helped science enormously in that respect. But of course, there's always other sides to it, and misinformation too gets communicated quickly. I think what's changed as a consequence of the internet and the online information environment is not the existence of misinformation, but it's rather the speed and the scale with which it can spread.
You mentioned the pandemic there, and in fact, the reception of COVID vaccines was pretty encouraging. I wonder whether that surprises you, really, because there are reasons to be seriously worried about the effects of scientific misinformation on society and on individuals. And we've seen climate change denial, and we've seen the anti-vax movement. Were you surprised by the readiness with which people came forward to have COVID vaccines?
If one looks at the take-up across different countries and looks at vaccine hesitancy across different countries, then it's interesting, and we do quite well in the UK by that count. And that's that touches on one of the main points of our report. I mean, it's often thought that, well, maybe what one should do is try to censor misinformation. But of course, it's not at all obvious across societies around the world that that is helpful. What causes people to not want to take vaccination is generally a loss of trust in the public health messages. And the difficulty with attempting to ban things is there's several difficulties. Knowing what to ban is one thing. But if it loses trust, if, for example, people become even more susceptible to conspiracy theories about what government or public health officials or whatever are trying to do to them, if there's things that encourage any kind of loss of trust are very, very damaging to things like vaccine take-up. So in this country, there's a generally quite a strong degree of trust in public health authorities, and we've seen that throughout the pandemic. And I think that's very important to maintain that trust.
It's interesting as well, isn't it? Because I think when we talk about this subject, people who are maybe susceptible to misinformation or sharing it for reasons that they think are quite positive, I think they're described as good Samaritans in your report, that if you tell them to stop or that they're doing something wrong, actually they perceive that as a trust issue. You know, that we don't trust people to find their own way through this information, or somehow something's being withheld from them. I think one of the things that I took away was the mistake it is to see people as a single entity, that people spreading misinformation are not a single entity. They do it for multiple different reasons. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's generally the case with the hostility to science, that people are coming from very different places, there isn't a single perspective, and surely that makes it really quite difficult to deal with?
I think that is true. I mean, if one looks in detail at the anti-vax movement, one finds at least three different motivations or groups. There's a group who have a kind of strong sort of purity sense, that they don't want to put into their bodies foreign things. There's a strong group, particularly in North America, that were of sort of anti-establishment, that they don't want to be told what to do by government. And then there's the group that you mentioned, which are people who in good faith think, well, I've seen this very worrying message, I should rapidly forward it to my friends and family. And you know, that's driven partly by a human instinct. I mean, we've evolved to react quickly to danger or to warnings. I mean, it was a successful strategy in the, you know, in a jungle. If you hear a noise that might be a tiger, then you run first and think about it later, or you warn others first and think about it later. And so things that trigger a alarm or a warning, or you know, I must tell my friends and family quickly. Things that trigger that response are often manipulated by people wanting to spread misinformation.
Yes, I wonder to what extent the solutions to the misinformation online are technological. You mention in your report the provenance-enhancing technology, and I wonder how would that work exactly?
I'll mention that. And it's a very interesting sort of mathematical area, actually. But just before that, the things that one can do about misinformation, some are technological, but many aren't. And for example, one of the very effective ways of attempting to deal with misinformation is kind of pre-inoculating the population. I mean, if you warn people that there will soon be misinformation about this or that or the other, then that takes away the surprise and the shock element of misinformation when it arises. And you'll notice that in the recent events in Ukraine, the US has definitely adopted that approach of preempting misinformation by alerting the population that it may be about to happen. But to your question, are there technological mechanisms? Provenance is one of the ways. Sometimes misinformation is spread quickly by by the illusion that it's come from a reputable source, from the BBC or CNN or something. So one thing that technology can do is try to help ensure that that sort of thing is true, that something that's supposed to have come from the BBC has actually come from the BBC. There are various ways of doing that, and one can think, for example, of images. So where is an image from? Well, you could add metadata to it that says where it's from, but of course that's easily stripped out. But it is possible to add into documents, into text, into images, cryptographically coded messages which allow you to deduce where the message is from. I mean, perhaps examples of this are in old spy movies where someone's reading a book and by putting together certain letters or a certain code can determine a secret message. Similarly, the steganography is a whole field whereby you can embed in an image or in a document, you can embed in a coded way information that can be extracted and can verify where a document is from. Other mechanisms of keeping track of where things have been are, you know, sort of current, currently much hyped example is blockchain, where you can look back at the history of an object. So there are technological mechanisms, but I would want to say that the technological mechanisms are just one and possibly not the leading way of counteracting false claims.
Two things actually. I'm fascinated by that idea that preempting a misinformation campaign can help people prepare for it and kind of sift their way through the information more effectively, and also that those technological solutions, which I have to say make me feel quite, I don't know, perplexed, I think is the word. They sound so high-tech. I'm not sure I fully understand how they would work. And I guess that takes me to my question, which is, I mean, you've found that most people couldn't identify deep fakes. And generally, we're not brilliant at this stuff, are we? People aren't great at sifting fact from fiction. Presumably, it's not a good idea to throw all the responsibility for that onto the individual user. We do need that blend of individual user interventions and technology.
We do, absolutely. And I suppose another main point of the report has been that there isn't a silver bullet to deal with misinformation. It's always been present. It's inevitable in the political sphere. Misinformation is inevitable in any kind of free and plural and open society, diverse society. There's bound to be misinformation of one type or another. There's no silver bullet. There are a collection of things that one can do, which each support the others, and one can't place all of the load onto an individual. It is possible to fool people easily. It's possible to fool the most, you know, as with, for example, magic tricks. The, scientists are most easily deceived by magic tricks. If you want to check out whether something's magic or not, you ask a magician rather than a scientist, even if it's ostensibly a scientific experiment that's being demonstrated. I think we all need help. However, it is the case that individuals can be more literate online. They can recognize deceptive links in web pages. They can recognize mechanisms that are used to lure them into things. Partly it is evolving. A new technology can fool us a few times, but then we get wise to it. And of course, young people are often, it seems to me, born with the ability to use technology. Since they've used it from a young age, they kind of have a sixth sense about what is right and what isn't right. But of course, they too, as they get older, will be deceived, and there'll be new risks and new problems. It's a continual battle. It'll never end.
Misinformation has always been with us, as you say. George Eliot and Dickens both knew what it was, and one of the reasons, I suppose, that new technology worries us so much is that it seems to be set up to prioritise the shocking and the controversial. And in the report, you talk about needing to look at what you call the incentives for production and consumption. And I wondered what you meant by this, whether you were talking about the money and the business model there.
I think we are. This is a wider area. I mean, the digital initiatives of the European Union and of other large trading blocs in different economies are beginning to face up to this. It is the case that quite often the amplification, the algorithmic amplification of messages driven by the desire to keep engagement of users or to generate clicks, which themselves may produce revenue, may produce advertising, those sorts of incentives do encourage things that shock. They have all sorts of malign effects. Now, that's a much wider problem than scientific misinformation. And I suppose the Royal Society's position as the National Academy of Sciences, we have a particular interest and knowledge and desire to speak about scientific misinformation. The much wider field of the problems of algorithmic amplification, they go much wider than science. And I think that one of the things scientists will need to do is to engage well with the economists and lawyers that are dealing with the more general problem. Scientific misinformation is a particularly difficult problem because it's very hard to work out what is scientific misinformation. Very often the perception of people is that science is a fixed body of knowledge. You can go and look up in a textbook what's true or not. Surely you can decide straight away whether something is misinformation or not. But of course, that isn't what active science looks like. Active science looks, well, it's been well illustrated in the pandemic. Young researchers are keen to find new sources of data, new questions, new ways of looking at things that expand our knowledge. And, they're very keen when they discover something that the previous generation of scientists have got wrong, or perhaps not wrong, but have not fully sorted out all of the implications and all of the boundaries of where things are true. Active young scientists are forever disputing with each other what's right and what's not right. And as information becomes available about in the pandemic, a new virus, then you expect a very large amount of uncertainty. You expect, for example, a scientific off-print to have to go through months of refereeing and editorial work and disputes between perhaps the author and the referees and the editor before the paper is, if it is, accepted for publication. So deciding what is misinformation, scientific misinformation, and what is not scientific misinformation is not an easy task. On the other hand, that's where active science happens, in arguing backwards and forwards about whether a certain set of data implies this or implies that. And so one has to be very careful with scientific misinformation that you don't damage the scientific process by attempting to restrict unnecessarily that debate.
That's a really interesting thought, isn't it? You know, through that debate, dispute, challenge, uncertainty, that's where science continually moves forward. Is that partly why you concluded that simply taking down this content isn't the answer? Were there other factors as well?
That's right. I mean, the problem is, how did you decide what to take down? I mean, you know, how do you decide whether something's scientific misinformation or not? Sometimes you can. I mean, sometimes it's clearly maliciously put on and it's just in error. Or it's misrepresenting numbers that have come from ONS or from other places. Sometimes it's clear. That's clear in those cases. But those aren't the scientifically interesting cases. The scientifically interesting cases are where the degree of uncertainty is so large that many, many possible explanations of a set of data or whatever are possible. And what one wants in that circumstance is for the scientific debate to be as open and transparent as possible. I mean, I think scientists do have a role there, because when scientists are communicating, they're kind of operating on a spectrum between kind of at one end informing and at another end persuading. And I think scientists have to be clear and transparent about what their motivation is. I mean, is it just to inform people about what the data is, what they've discovered, or is it to step a little bit further towards the the sort of political end of the spectrum and say, well, this data tells us we should do X or Y or Z. Very often that step towards we should do X or Y or Z involves not just the science, the science is the wrong word, not just scientific information, but it involves also value judgments. It involves all sorts of other considerations for which the scientist, as a member of society, has input, but does not necessarily in those areas have any preferred reason to be listened to than other communicators.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And of course, in the pandemic, scientists were called upon all the time to make value judgments and kind of to give the lead, and to support and lead the lines that politicians wanted to give us. With anti-vax disinformation, one of the things that has been tried is directing people to better information. And I wonder to what extent you think it's feasible to do that kind of annotation with unscientific content or to direct people elsewhere to better sources. And if that were a way of dealing with bad information, if you like, or disinformation, whose responsibility would this be? Because the platforms don't particularly want to take it on. And to be fair to them, it would be an enormous amount of work. I mean, they did do it over COVID to some extent, but if they were required to do it across the whole range of scientific information, you can imagine that they would hardly have time to do anything else. They'd have to employ an awful lot of scientists.
That's right. That's a very interesting question, and it's one of the things we did spend some time thinking about. And I mentioned earlier that the challenge presented by the online information environment is the speed and scale. And what one has to think of is a way that the sort of ecosystem, the scientific ecosystem, can react with a corresponding speed and scale. So one of the times when information does spread rapidly is when there isn't an authoritative voice. So over COVID or over a pandemic, then the public health authorities internationally, WHO or Public Health England or whatever, are an attempt at an authoritative voice. But one of the examples that we considered at length in the report was 5G. I mean, that there have been people that have thought 5G has all sorts of terrible effects, causing COVID for some of them, but all sorts of other ones as well. And that has produced, in a small number of people that have believed that misinformation, has produced violence. I mean, the telecom engineer was injured in one of the many attacks on 5G towers. One of the things that occurred in that area was that there wasn't a single authoritative voice, or there wasn't any authoritative voice, really. It fell between different stools about who it would be that would speak knowledgeably about you know, possible dangers of 5G, of electromagnetic radiation or whatever. And so one of the things that I think, where the ecosystem could help here is if you imagine that the information available to tech platforms can allow them to deduce what things are rapidly spreading virally. They can ask fact checkers, and they do employ sometimes fact checkers to check things. But, you know, as we've said, it's very often difficult to decide whether something's true or not if it's concerned with scientific uncertainty. But one of the things that could happen is that the combination of data from platforms and initial passes over this data by fact checkers could alert scientific authorities, could alert, for example, learned academies, the Royal Society or specialist scientific academies, that there is a question arising here. It's beginning to be discussed. It's beginning to potentially produce misinformation. And, oh, great learned society, who are the experts in this field of science or that field of science, could you please produce a 2 or 3 pager describing what we know, what we don't know, and what things we're likely to know from future experiments? So that would at least allow information, it would at least allow information deserts to be dealt with, so that when a new problem arose, that misinformation wasn't being allowed to propagate unchallenged. There would at least be something that had some sort of scientific credibility that described what we know, what we don't know, and the uncertainties.
What you're describing sounds like a missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle that would be relatively straightforward to put in place. I mean, obviously, I would say the platforms, as you describe, would have to contribute to that. And we already have fact checkers, although clearly they can't fact check everything. But having that authoritative voice feels like something that would make a really significant difference. Do you think it's important that we need to put some public money behind this? Does it need that level of independence and commitment from government that we're going to do that?
Well, I suppose over things like fact checkers or over things like this, government money is two-sided. Of course, the money helps, but of course, the trust in institutions or whatever may be compromised by an apparent loss of independence. So I think, for example, for fact checkers, we mentioned in the report the importance of their support. Charities, charitable funders of research and of science will need to support fact checkers. I think that sort of support allows them to keep their independence and to often give a line that might not be that of government. But I think one has to be careful here. One wants to maintain trust, and the best way to maintain trust is to be trustworthy, to be competent and honest and reliable.
We talk about big tech, and yet there are new functionalities being promoted and developed all the time. And some groups who would spread disinformation in bad faith are now moving to smaller platforms. So I wonder to what extent you think it's difficult to kind of get ahead of the game. We're looking at the growth of encryption. Is that going to make monitoring the spread of misinformation and disinformation harder? Is the sort of splintering of users off into smaller platforms where they're less well seen also going to make it much harder?
It does make it harder. We have in the report mentioned the issue of smaller platforms. Of course, by definition, they won't have quite the impact of the large platforms. But on the other hand, they do tend to be where some of the more harmful content thrives. We think it would be sensible for Ofcom to have smaller platforms within their focus too. I think that private platforms and encryption are other issues too. Quite a lot of misinformation gets spread on private platforms, so things like WhatsApp. And there have been various attempts there to deal with that. I mean, if you prevent a message being forwarded too often, so you put limits on it so it can only be forwarded a certain number of times, or these sorts of things can help, and there's been various experimentations with that. So I think that smaller platforms, private networks, all sorts of things like that are going to have to be are going to become more important in the spread of misinformation as the larger platforms get better at suppressing it dealing with it. As I say, I don't think there's ever going to be a point at which one can declare one's won this war. It's a continual battle.
I guess one part of the battle is the Online Safety Bill. Since your report came out in January, the government's introduced the Online Safety Bill, which gets its second reading after Easter. It's very long, it's very complex. We certainly haven't grasped it all yet. But I wonder, do you have an initial reaction to it?
Well, nor me. I mean, I've looked at some of it, but I wouldn't claim to be an expert on it. I mean, I think part of the problem with if one thinks of the whole system of society, the legislature, the judiciary, the public, then the question of misinformation is an interesting one at the moment. As we say in the report, there are things that one should absolutely censor and ban, and those things are things that are illegal, things that encourage violence or hate crime or whatever. There are things that are defined as illegal, and of course we have a legislature that decides what it is that should be illegal, and then we have a judiciary that can look at the cases and decide whether it falls within the legislation or not. And that works okay for things that are for those things that fall within that category. When one gets to things like scientific misinformation, then you know, I mentioned the difficulty of deciding whether it's misinformation or not. And so then the response becomes less concerned with, is it a binary decision? Should you just ban it or not? It becomes more concerned with the extent to which one looks at algorithmic amplification or the various ways that the opposite of amplification, things like limiting the number of times something gets spread or asking someone before they retweet a headline with an article, that you just ask someone, have you actually read the article? I mean, that's actually quite an effective mechanism to prevent kind of misleading headlines that don't correspond to the article from being amplified. So there are many things that are between a zero and a one, between saying, well, we'll ban it or we'll not ban it. There are lots of things in the middle which are concerned with the extent to which something gets amplified or not. And I suspect will become the platforms, the scientific learned academies and whatever will become much more effective in the future at just knowing where, how to adjust the knob on that sort of thing. To what extent is something likely to be... Is it harmful to amplify this or not? And I think this relates back to also to the point earlier about the various forms of business model for amplification. I think the platforms will, in time, balance not just the tendency of people to click or to be engaged with a message. They'll balance that against the other kind of downsides of certain types of message.
I love that image of all the things between the zero and the one. And it is the lawful but awful stuff in the middle that is the real problem, the devil in the detail here, because I don't think anybody's in any doubt that the illegal stuff shouldn't be happening. It's all the stuff that, a lot of which is hate speech and much of which may well be scientific disinformation, which is the problem. And I do completely agree with you that if something can be done about the amplification systems, that would be enormously helpful. But we also have to look at users, and we all have a responsibility, I suppose, to be a bit more savvy about the way that we use information online and we approach it. And of course, information literacy is not the whole answer, and we certainly shouldn't be blaming users for things that are imposed on them by algorithmic systems. But it is part of the answer. And I wonder whether it's going to be enough to teach information literacy in schools, or whether, in fact, we're all going to have to keep working on our media literacy throughout our lives, partly because of what we've just been talking about, the constant kind of upgrades in functionality and the changes in the way that information reaches us. Is that something that you foresee? And do you think that we're kind of ready to do that or equipped to do that?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. We will have to keep upgrading our information literacy. I mean, I think there's the rate of technological progress, the rate of change. We'll need to do that for many reasons. Just people will be changing jobs, changing areas. That'll happen several times over someone's lifetime. You may say, "Well, I would say this, wouldn't I?" But as a mathematician, but I think the basic data literacy of children leaving school and of adults in work and throughout the whole workforce, throughout the population, I think there's a lot that can be done about basic data literacy. I mean, sometimes misinformation is quite apparent should be quite apparent. You know, sometimes you see, even in national newspapers, you see, you know, a percentage is given where you just know that the number must be a billion rather than a million, or where percentages are clearly, you know, a percentage of a percentage often produces some error where someone thinks something's gone up by 5%, whereas in fact it's gone up from a very small percentage to a slightly higher percentage, which is itself 5% higher than the earlier percentage. I think that, you know, they produce, there are very, in statistical journals, for example, there are often little private eye-like little sections where things are quoted from national newspapers, which are just, to a statistician, hilarious misconceptions. And I think that I'm sorry that those things aren't enjoyed as good jokes by more school children leaving school. It is one way to try to deal with it. But you know, we really should be able to spot that that numbers are being manipulated to try and shock you, when in fact there's nothing at all unusual about the numbers you're seeing in for this or that or the other. So I think data literacy is something that is absolutely basic, and you know, our ability to have a level of numeracy that is expected of us. Failures of literacy would be viewed as shocking, and sometimes failures of numeracy are not seen as shocking, and I think that's a shame. But it's not just that; it's also all sorts of other things that we mentioned earlier about provenance, about being alert to what it is that's likely to deceive you, to click on the wrong thing or to give away your credit card details, all this stuff and the other. There are many, many things, and of course, again, it'll keep evolving. You know, as people become better and better at not giving away their credit card details, then fraudsters will think of other ways by which we can be misled. So, I do think it's a lifetime task to keep oneself safe online.
That resonates so much with me, that idea of us needing to become more data numerate. I remember a friend really telling me off, saying that I didn't really like maths and I didn't really engage with it. And she said, you would never, ever say that in front of a child about reading and writing. But for some reason, we've all given ourselves permission to say, oh, I'm a bit rubbish at maths.
Yeah, I think that's right. And a sort of damaging idea is that people are either, you know, are born as being good at maths or not good at maths. You wouldn't say that about reading or writing. I mean, these are skills. You know, some people are better at it than others. Some people have an aptitude for it. But it's an essential life skill. And it's damaging to children to give them the impression that somehow they're, it's not for them. Quite often, it's just a matter of curiosity and interest. I mean, you know, when I take my grandchildren to school occasionally, we drop in for a baby chino and divide up a few chocolate tiffins and things. And even at quite young ages, they know the difference between a half and a third.
And whether they're getting their fair share, presumably.
Does go back to what we were talking about earlier before we started recording, and about maths education. I certainly feel that people didn't excite me enough about mathematics, really. I'm thinking back now over my career as broadsheet journalist, wondering how many of those mathematical illiteracy phenomena were mine. I do think we could do better at exciting children somehow.
I think so, and it's often the case that a good start is not to tell them they're doing mathematics. I mean, if you just describe sort of real world problems of one type or another. I mean, I don't think my grandchildren thought I was doing maths with them when we were dividing up the chocolate tiffin. I mean, they just thought they were doing something really important, like making sure they got the fair share of it or whatever. I think, you know, quite often rather subtle mathematical concepts can be got across by discussions of other topics, you know, of topics that are just everyday topics in the life of a child. There's many, many ways of encouraging children and of reacting to what it is that's top of their mind at the time you're talking to them.
I have a final question for you, and it's taking us to a slightly different place, but just I'd be super interested to hear your thoughts on this one. Do you think that scientists are becoming more cautious about sharing their ideas because when something's out on the internet, it's so difficult to control? Or do you think it genuinely is an opportunity for that vibrant exchange of views and argument and discussion? In other words, are you feeling optimistic about the future of science communication?
I think there's work to do. I mean, I do think following the pandemic, there are a number of younger scientists who feel quite burnt. They were, in good faith sharing their views and this, that, and the other, and they find themselves on the wrong end of a large amount of abuse. And I think that has caused some of them to retreat a bit from sharing things. And I think that's a shame. On the other hand, I think the importance of science to society in general has become much clearer. So I think that interest in science is increased. Scientific communication is really important. I mean, as our society continues to become more technologically based, and as science pervades more and more of our lives, then an informed citizenry that's able to understand what the issues are is more and more important. So I think scientific communication is hugely, hugely important. It's not easy, but it's important.
Thank you so much, Frank, for an absolutely fascinating conversation. It's a really good report and a really important subject, I think. And you're right, interest in science will increase. And it's so wonderful when scientists are able to articulate science so clearly. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Tech Shock from Parent Zone. I'm Vicky Shotbolt.
And I'm Geraldine Bedell. Listen to Tech Shock every week on a Monday, wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to sign up, download, and please do give us a 5-star rating so other people can be helped to find us.